Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the London School of Economics and Political Science for this panel discussion on the topic of geography of discontent, Euroscepticism in regions of stagnant growth. The event is part of our LSE festival that this year, it runs throughout the week until Saturday, and this year the theme is Power and Politics. My name is Susanna Morato. I'm the Vice President and Pro-Vice Chancellor for Research here at LSE and also a professor in environmental economics. I'm delighted to be here this lunchtime to welcome our speakers, Professor Andres Rodriguez-Pose, James Blagden, and Dr. Özge Olmer. Thank you very much for coming here to speak to us during this lunchtime. And of course, I would like to thank our audience, both those here in the Wolfson Theatre and also those online. Let's say a few words about our speakers before we start. James Blagden is Associate Director for Research and Insights at More in Common, a nonpartisan organization that aims to understand and address the forces driving people apart and find common ground. Before joining More in Common, he was head of politics and polling at the think tank Onward, where he worked on changing values and voting patterns of the electorate. He identified the Workington man, the key swing voter, ahead of the 2019 elections. That was someone that used to vote Labour but then voted Brexit in the 2016 referendum. Dr. Özge Olmer is Associate Professor in Spatial Economics and Real Estate at the Department of Land Economy in the University of Cambridge. And she's also a fellow there at Sydney Sussex College. She has a PhD in economics with a focus on urban and regional economics from Jönköping University in Sweden. And part of her studies were at the University of Illinois. Professor Andres Rodriguez-Pose is the Princesa de Asturias Chair and Professor of Economic Geography here at LSE at the Department of Geography and Environment. He is the director of the Cañada Blanche Center at LSE that organizes this event, and it's a center for fostering research and engagement between the UK and Spain. And he also chairs the high-level group on the future of cohesion policy. They are tasked with proposing a new cohesion policy for the European Union post-2027. Each panelist will speak for 5 to 7 minutes, followed by a brief discussion, and then I will open the room for questions, both online and here in the room, in the last 20, 30 minutes. So there'll be time for questions then. Before we start, let me just add how delighted I am to be chairing this incredibly timely debate today. The European Parliament elections just last weekend, you might have seen those, brought to the fore a growing wave of discontent across Europe, particularly in places that are experiencing prolonged stagnation and demographic decline. The discontent was reflected in increased support for Eurosceptic parties, as well as for far-right national sort of parties. A significant driver of this phenomenon is, of course, economic stagnation, and that leads to, and in particular, the development trap that I'm sure we will hear about, where regions face persistent decline in GDP per capita, employment, and productivity. These areas, unable to keep pace with other more dynamic regions, have a feeling of being left behind, of relative deprivation. And this disillusionment then causes the swing to the right and the Euroscepticism. So today, this panel will discuss what is required to combat this situation, this geography of discontent, and how economic and social roots of this Euroscepticism can be mitigated. So the event is being recorded, and we will hopefully be made available as a podcast if there are no technical difficulties. For those who are X users, formerly known as Twitter, the hashtag for today is hashtag LSE Festival, and please turn your phones to mute now as well, and let's start the event. I'm delighted to hand over to Professor Andres Rodriguez-Pose.
Thank you very much, Susanna, and thank you very much to Özge and to James and to all of you for being here to discuss this rise in discontent and your skepticism across Europe. And it comes at a very timely moment because we had the European elections, in which the main group that actually made inroads has been the Eurosceptic parties, populists very often to the right of the spectrum that have in countries like, for example, Cyprus, but also Portugal, Spain, Italy, made significant inroads with respect to where we were. And of course, you can say, well, that's normal because the European parliamentary elections are considered as second-order elections. They are regarded by most Europeans as elections that really do not matter that much. And that's why people vote less, and then when they vote more for the streams. But the problem is deeply embedded, because if we go beyond the European elections that we had this week, and we look at national elections over the last cycle, between 2018 and 2023, so every single national elections, parliamentary elections, first order, the ones that matter, what we have is now 28.7% of Europeans that cast their votes for parties that are Eurosceptic, that are, in some cases, hard Eurosceptic, that they want the demise of the European Union, or they challenge some basic principles of the European Union, like the euro or the primacy of European law, or they are, let's say, soft Eurosceptics. These soft Eurosceptics are parties that actually do not challenge the existence of the European Union, but want to change profoundly the way we see the European Union. So it's not a European Union of constant European integration, but, for example, a European Union of countries or of peoples, and with a very different perspective. So let me just go why this has happened. This is something new, because if we go to 2004, 20 years ago, hard Eurosceptic parties in national elections got 2% of the vote. Together with soft, it was around 4.5%. But there was discontent already brewing. Every time there was a referendum, the voters in the Netherlands or in France, like the constitutional referendums, voted against the European Union and more integration. Then came the financial crisis and the austerity crisis. And from 2012, what we saw was a massive jump. That in terms of hard Eurosceptics, which are now at around 15%, increased massively until 2016. What happened in 2016? The Brexit vote, and people said, let's wait and see what happens to the UK. But soft Eurosceptics have kept on growing, and we are there at almost 30% of national votes there. The question is why? Why is this happening, and what are the risks? And I think it's basically since the day of the Brexit vote, we had our colleagues, in the Department of Government trying to find explanations and across the board. And most of the explanations have come is a cultural thing. It's like Mark Goodgun and others have said, it's all about old, angry, uneducated white men. So that are in this world in which they feel it's a world that is not the same as it was before, that they feel as strangers in their own home. They are ill at ease with a more cosmopolitan Europe, with a more cosmopolitan Britain. And as a result of that, what we are having is this generational divide. And some people came on television saying, we just have to wait until this oldest generation dies and the problem will go away. Of course, it was macabre. It's not the truth. Cultural factors matter. Low levels of education, more men vote against European integration. But what is also very important is the economic dimension. There are a lot of places that have fallen through the policy cracks. European Union policy has been targeting the less developed regions at the fringes of Europe. National policies very often are aspatial, but when you put them on a map, the impact is fundamentally on the most dynamic regions. What happens to the old industrial regions, the north of England, the West Midlands, the north of France, the north of Italy, that were, until not that long ago, drivers of economic growth, but they have been declining for a long time. And with colleagues at the LSE, Simona Iannarino, Michael Storper, Andreas Diemers, we have developed this idea of the development trap. What is the development trap? We measure the dynamism of regions, not just based on GDP per capita, but adding GDP per capita, employment and productivity. And we compare that with the performance of the region itself in the past, relative to the country the region is in, and relative to the whole of the European Union. And what do we find is that in Europe, there are very many regions that have been, over the last 2 to 3 decades, stuck in a development trap. That many of those that get stuck in this development trap remain there for very long periods. If we do the same example, and Ali is here doing that for the US, regions in the US that are become stuck in a development trap, they come out relatively quickly. In Europe, they stay there forever. And then they say, well, if I'm in a development trap, if I'm not, I'm stagnant for a year, then we'll be better off next year. If I'm stagnant for 5 years, then there will be a policy solution. If you've been like that for 2 decades, then you give up. And you say, you are not the only one who's going to pay. So I'm going to go to the extremes and show that the place where I live matters. And that's the main factor. When we look and connect stagnation, the development trap, to the rise of Eurosceptic vote, we find that the risk of being in a development trap, the intensity of the development trap, and the duration of the development trap matters. And the bigger the intensity and the longer the duration, the more important and the more likely are people in these areas that have been losing out to vote for anti-system voters, anti-system parties. To give you some rough dimension, if you've been stuck in a development trap for 2 decades, you're 7 times more likely to vote for anti-European parties than if you've been stuck just for 2 years. And I'm just going to finish with one point. We have a problem. 60 million Europeans in the European Union today live in places with GDP per capita that are lower than what it was in the year 2000. 135 million, or one third of the population of the European Union, in places that have slowly fallen behind with levels of growth of less than 0.5%. And this is creating a significant problem in which we are opting for parties that are, in many cases, challenging not just European integration, but challenging the world we live in with all its problems, and challenging democracy in some cases. So what we need to do is to try to make sure that we find solutions that very often involve tackling the problems of development of where many Europeans live, in order to make sure that the system that we have, which is imperfect, which can be reformed, but is much better than anything that our parents and grandparents lived through, can be reformed, can be adapted, but can be made viable for everyone to live in a far more prosperous and dynamic and equitable Europe. Thank you.
Thank you, Andres. Oskar, over to you.
Hi. Hello, everyone. So I had a completely different text in mind, but we have been discussing a little bit before coming here with Andres, and I changed the plot, so to say. Let me give you a little bit about my background, because I will make a disproportionate references to a few countries when I'm talking about Euroscepticism specifically, but the discontent voting phenomena in general. I was born and raised in Turkey, but I've spent a big chunk of my adult life in Sweden. And I was introduced into academia during the height of the migration crisis, and doing urban and regional economics, it was inevitable for many academics, including myself, to take part in that debate. And it's been about 6 years since I am in Cambridge. I still keep a foot in Turkey, and I'm engaged with politics there too. So it's a bit of a mess, because in none of these countries there is political stability, and they are all messed up in a different way. So that it takes a large amount of time just to be able to follow the developments in these countries. I sometimes joke, actually, that if I am to follow the news in for all these three countries, it would be a part-time job, but just doing nothing but reading the news. That being said, one thing that is common in many countries, including these three that I mentioned, is how often we use the same terminology to describe different political dynamics. So we talk about Euroscepticism. It means one thing in one country. It means a completely different thing in another country. Same goes for discontent voting, revenge voting. Even the terminology far right is a little vague. What is being considered far right, for example, in Sweden now is the second largest party, Sweden Democrats. And for Sweden Democrats, one of the blocks that we were talking about in the EU ID is far too right, so that they wouldn't take part. So that they find themselves more mainstream than some of the other more far right parties in other countries. So these are not binary definitions, obviously, that there's no dichotomous way by which we can say this party is far right and this party is not. And this is by and large due to the fact that these parties, as they gain popularity, really adjusted their position on many issues, right? As they actually became more mainstream, as they moved towards the center of the political spectrum, what happened is that it was very appetizing for former center politicians to actually gain or carve some of this popularity for themselves so that they started moving towards the ends of the spectrum, which left us with what I call a vacuum, a void in the center of the political spectrum. So we have to be very careful when we are at this point talking about a center party in any of the countries, because some of the positions we see in major issues like migration, climate crisis, both domestic and international security were being held by former far-right parties. And now some of these far-right parties are voicing opinions that are, what were we saying? Vaguely sensible, if what we were saying coming into the room. So these positions keep changing all the time. But one thing that is common in almost all countries is that there's an ever-growing void in the center of the political spectrum. So let's say our objective is to save the center politics. Then we should ask ourselves, what do we mean by center politics? It is a deeply spatial phenomenon, obviously, because center politics traditionally in continental Europe mostly, but in other parts of the world also, is being represented by the urban elite that's based in the capital or large metropolitan areas that had very good understanding, a very good grasp of what was happening in other countries in the world, but increasingly detached from other parts of the same country that they are located. We have a geographer, a late Waldo Tobler, in the 70s, based on some gravitational idea, said everything is related to everything, but near things are more related to each other than distant things. So what happened that actually was very important for the kind of structural change we are observing in the way politics is being done in most countries is that while major cities became more similar to each other, both in terms of its demographic composition, in terms of their political position, in terms of their economic dynamics, they are increasingly detached from the rest of the country. And that's why I found it extremely useful to rely on Andres's work on the revenge of the places that don't matter. So we see this as a common theme in almost all countries. When it comes to this sentiment of discontent, the sentiment of revenge being manifested in voters' preferences, particularly with reference to Euroscepticism, there we have a little bit of a problem too, because if you look at Eurobarometer, I know some of you, maybe at least my student friends here, may be using it for your assignments and your essays. There are multiple questions to measure in member states how people feel about European Union as a structure. There's a set of questions related to how what's the degree of trust towards the EU. But there are also more binary questions, such as, would you want to exit the EU? Would you want to depart from the EU? We see that people's preference for remaining in the European Union stayed relatively stable over the years, while the level of trust has been in decline. With the exception of 2 years ago or 1.5 years ago with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there was like this uplift of trust towards the EU. But we see that people want to remain in the EU so that they actually believe in the importance of EU, but they don't trust EU and less so over the years. So there I always advise, I mean, growing up in a country during the 80s and 90s when becoming a part of the EU was a thing, and now it's not even a part of the political agenda in Turkey. And then moving to a country like Sweden, where exiting EU is not a part of the political debate at all. Even the most extreme right that you would find is very critical towards the EU, but never really campaigning actively to exit the EU. When I arrived in the UK some 6 years ago, I always advised my EU evangelist friends that if you want to actually preserve the union, one thing that you must do is to look into what it is that makes people trust less the structure itself. And there I want to highlight one thing before I wrap up, and that is the fact that European Union is an ever-expanding organization. That it is so complex. If you go to Brussels, those of you who have been to Brussels would know, people working in the parliament or people working in the commission, if you ask them to describe you some structures that are nested within the European Union, they often fail to describe you how things work. So the supranational organization became so, in my opinion, monstrous that actually it was inevitable that in certain realms of governance, in certain domains of governance, there would be failings and fragilities. And it's a politician's natural reaction. It's a politician's reflex. When you ask a politician, what should we do about this problem? The automatic response is, we should do more. We should do more about this. Perhaps in certain issues, at the European Union level, at the supranational level, maybe the answer is we should do less and let the countries govern themselves on this particular issue, let them fail if they fail, which they will, because these problems are far too complex than the populist narrative suggests, obviously, which would potentially highlight the importance of center politics, which is known to deal with complex problems by way of complex solutions. So that I will leave it here. I believe we will talk more about other things too.
Thank you very much. James, over to you now.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm going to talk a bit about, well, three things I think are interesting. The first one is, as mentioned in the introductions, Workington Man, which was an archetype that we discovered in 2019, looking at some of the polling data on the kinds of voters that had drifted from Labour historically towards UKIP in the 2000s, 2010s, and then were increasingly amenable to voting Conservative with the right kind of electoral strategy. And so just a bit of brief context. So Workington Man is an archetype. It's a kind of voter who is older than average, male, didn't go to university, voted for Brexit in 2016, and is increasingly dissatisfied with the way that the country is working. We ask questions around trust in politics. It's very, very low for this group compared to the national average. And then the kind of sense of political agency, efficacy, very low compared to average as well. And they cluster in constituencies known as the Red Wall, parts of the North and Midlands of England where living standards have declined partly as a result of deindustrialization. But if you look at the average wages in these seats, most people are no, well, in 2019 at least, were no better off than they were in 2006. Very stagnant. And that I think is partly why we see these sorts of places where these sorts of voters cluster being so politically interesting recently and having such wild shifts. A town like Workington, for instance, had never voted Conservative in its history, but did that time. So these things do matter for our politics. The second thing I want to mention is around who is this resentment directed towards? There's a strain of thought that maybe these towns around cities that have seen traditional industries decline direct animosity towards the nearby thriving metropolitan liberal city. And you can see it play out in a sort of a low-key sort of way in football rivalries between, say, Newcastle and Sunderland. And if you do focus groups in these places, occasionally you get someone say, yeah, but what's the point? Because all the city just attracts all the investment, all the jobs, all the growth just gets sucked into Newcastle rather than us down here. So we tried to poll that, and we polled people in five towns around four or five English cities and asked them these kind of questions around zero-sum thinking, around growth, around investment. And we found that actually that opinion is not widely held. Most people in smallish to medium-sized towns around cities like London, Birmingham, Manchester, Newcastle, Leeds, think that when the city near them grows, they will grow too. Zero-sum thinking is quite rare. There's some nuance depending on the question wording you ask, but generally people tend to think that if the city grows, that will trickle out to them eventually. And they want the city to have opportunities because it benefits them generally. So that's kind of an interesting finding. And then the third one I wanted to mention has been a bit disjointed, but things that I think are kind of cool to discuss later on, perhaps, is around, I discovered recently that in Germany, they hold youth elections in schools for people of secondary school age to coincide with the European elections. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you get quite a large sample and you can ask, what do people aged 13, 14 in Germany think about politics? And the map is it's amazing. Kids in East Germany voted for the AfD and kids in West Germany vote for CDU. Very clear demarcation there. And I think what's fascinating is that these are sort of 13-year-olds, haven't experienced the 20, 30 years of relative decline compared to West Germany that their parents and grandparents have. Nonetheless, living in those places, they vote in line with the adult population. So that's an example of why place matters just as much as people's own experience.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Before opening questions, I'll ask a question myself. This is a fascinating topic. I'm wondering what the green revolution and green technologies have to offer to minimize the development gap. There was a narrative that thought, oh, this is the future. We have all these technologies, new perspective, employment, and so on. But we noticed the far-right party is also taking the environment. That's something that they don't like, and reducing their environmental sort of credentials and policies. So what is your view on the future of what does the green agenda have to offer to this agenda of Euroscepticism?
Should I? Yeah. Okay. I think that's a very important question, because the green agenda is, first, there's an undeniable climate crisis, and we need to fight it. If we don't take action now, we're probably going to have no planet to defend in two generations or even before. So there's a need, and Europe has taken the lead in that respect with an ambitious Green Deal. But we also realize, as you have highlighted, that all anti-system populist parties, normally to the right, they're targeting people in areas, the rural areas. They look for portfolios in agriculture and forestry and rural development, anything, because they know that in these areas, the green agenda has become highly unpopular. And why is that? Because we have, and there's a lot of research that has gone into analyzing the impact of climate change. We know where we are going to have more impact of the increasing temperatures. We're going to have more, extreme events. But the Green Deal has been introduced to tackle that with the vague idea that is going to be beneficial in the long run. And it's probably true that it's going to be beneficial in the long run, but we don't know whether the impact is going to be in the short and medium term. And that creates a problem. It creates a problem for many areas, because we're saying, yes, we're going to do so much investment into those areas, and that is going to bring benefits for the whole of Europe or for the whole of the world. The reality, or the perception of the reality, is very different. People in rural areas in most of Europe, where it is in the core, like in the Netherlands, or in parts of Spain, parts of Italy, they realize that the Green Deal is going to be capital intensive, is going to be labor extensive. There's going to be a lot of money. The panels are now going to be perhaps a bit now with reshoring, but they're not going to be built in Romania or in Italy or in Workington. They're going to be built in China, and there's going to be a conflict with the use of land that they have. So yes, if we have a lot of solar panels here or wind turbines, what is it going to be the benefit for us? And they are realizing that the benefit is going to happen everywhere else, but in their place. To give you an idea, there's going to be a lot of investment in research and development into green technologies, but 70% of all European regions do not produce a single pattern in green technologies. So just to wrap up, we're going to have dilemmas like the ones in Almería. Almería is a region in the south east of Spain that is the only semi-desert region in Europe. So, and they are very aware that if they don't do anything to prevent climate change, they're going to be in a region that is unlivable because of high temperatures and lack of water in 20 years. So they are very conscious of climate change. But they have been specialized in two sectors. One is tourism. The other one is intensive greenhouse agriculture for the rest of Europe and the rest of the world. If you, instead of taking your holidays in Almería, you decide that, well, because it's better for the climate and the environment, you go to Brighton or Great Yarmouth. It might be good for working to the man, etc. But it's really bad for Almería. And if you instead of decide to having your lettuce and your tomatoes, which are mostly produced in Almería or in other parts of, I was going to say Europe, but also the other parts of the world, instead of having those, you decide that you only eat lettuce in the 2 weeks that they are produced here in the UK, then Almería has got a short term. And this is something that has been exploited by these parties. And this is a whole motto that's saying, I've heard several anti-system parties saying, people in Brussels or in our national governments are worried about the end of the world. Mm-hmm. My voters are worried about the end of the month. Mm-hmm. How do you square the circle is where we have the solution.
Thank you, Andres. Do you have any quick comments? It's been fascinating.
Maybe one quick comment on the European Green Deal. It is, I mean, other than the green technology and how it can be adapted and what the cost of it would be for particularly for the rural population, farmers or others involved in fishery and forestry in many European countries. It is essentially an implicit protectionist trade agenda. And what one thing that I find quite interesting is that this is not being communicated, right? So it's effects, its potential effects, both in the short run, medium run, and long run, its potential effects on how the employment structure will change should the European Green Deal be implemented in the future, and how it will actually favor domestic employment to a larger extent. So it's, to me, a little bit, at the end of the day, political narrative building exercise. And one thing that I hear a lot is the technology adaptation and how the green energy can be produced and distributed across the member states, and how the power structure prohibits it or enables it. But perhaps we should talk more about its potential effects on employment. Because when you look at the population that's being persuaded by the right-wing extreme right parties to vote against the green agenda at large, but European Green Deal in specifically, I am not entirely certain if they understand what European Green Deal is or what it will mean for them in the short run, let alone long run. Does anybody here watch soap operas? I like soap operas quite a lot. But I have a few friends who are working professionally as political communicators, spin doctors, both in Sweden and in Turkey, and we often talk about how it is similar, building a storytelling, building a political narrative around an issue is similar to what you see in the soap operas. You need two things: desires and values. So you have an agenda, European Green Deal. What do you desire and what kind of values it threatens or it praises? And it's not going to be the same for everybody across the country. So it's going to be different for the working class than it is for the farmer, than it is for the urban elite and so on. So it's a question of, I guess, identifying what they desire and which values these desires correspond to when it comes to Green Deal. And I think employment could be a good pitch.
Absolutely.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ, ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Well, so in the UK at least, it feels like the support, but at least look at the data from when we poll people in the UK, support for the net zero target generally has held up pretty consistently over the last few years. Not been a lot of change and not a lot of backlash or greenlash, whatever you want to call it, in the UK at least. And I wonder if part of that is because in the UK we've had it enacted by the Conservative government, and they also haven't called it Green New Deal. The policy is the net zero target, and they've called it Levelling Up.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Yes. I'm going to move on to the audience. We could go on forever because it's been such fantastic presentations and absolutely insightful discussion afterwards. I'm going to start by asking three questions here from the audience. Woman there with the white shirt. Yeah, I had forgotten to say your name and where you're from, so thank you for that.
I'm a current master's student at LSE. So the EU has been particularly proactive with data protection and trying to regulate social media, communications, artificial intelligence. Given the impact of big tech on certain trajectories of economic vitality, do you think that this effort to protect citizens could actually backfire by reinforcing democratic backsliding and civil discontent? Mm.
Who wants to answer? Oh, no, sorry, I'll take two more just so you can then choose a couple more. Gentlemen over there.
Hi, I'm Donald Prowse, I'm a visitor here. You talked about employment. Joe Biden, 80% of his jobs for the Green IRA have gone to red states, but he doesn't seem to be making much progress there.
Thank you. One more question from the room. Gentleman there in the middle. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for the discussion. It's very enlightening. My question is about the Green Deal policies. And do you think that the European Union and respective national governments have failed in properly engaging with rural stakeholders when trying to implement the policies, communicating with them, making them feel a part of organic farming policies, etc.? Specifically, given the context set by the farmers' protests, which took over Europe last year.
Could you just
I'm a visitor me, from.
Where you're from?
I'm Deep. I'm a visitor. I'm from IDS Python.
Thank you. Okay, three very interesting questions on AI, employment, and the Green Deal. So, anyone wants to answer any? AI would have been my next question if I
okay.
had.
But,
yeah.
Should I start?
Please.
All right. So let me start with Biden drive towards a territorial policy and an industrial policy, which is a complete detour from what has happened in the US since the 1970s, more or less. The idea that there's going to be an industrial policy as a result of, let's say, strategic autonomy, but this industrial policy barely disguises a territorial policy in which the aim is to try to promote economic dynamism and the creation of jobs in those places that have been falling behind for a long time. So from West Virginia to all the Rust Belt in the US. Why is it not working? It's probably not working because it's too early and it comes a bit too late. This is something that probably needed to be done by any of the previous administrations. Trump, despite the fact of championing these regions, did nothing for them, nor did Obama or the Bush administration or the Clinton or the Bush senior for that sake, and not to mention the Reagan administration. So in that respect, the period of decline has been too long. Second, it's not just late, it's relatively small. We're talking about a substantial amount of money. We're talking about a drive of $80 billion over the period of 4 years, which is the current administration. To put it in perspective, that sounds like a lot of money. But to put it in perspective, the European Union for the current programming period is spending 392 billion euros in just in the in for the less developed regions, more than for the declining regions. So it does take time, and it you want to react to that.
Can I react one thing? The IRA is a small fraction of the private investment that's gone in, and you take the IRA and the private investment, it makes the EU look small.
I would disagree with that, because the private investment is massively, in territorial terms, is massively still channeled to the cores and the dynamic areas. Well, fine, let's go. But it's still far, it's probably far too late and far too small in that respect. I mean, if you want, you can talk to the guys at the Brookings Institution that are working on this. And that's that it counterbalances the centripetal forces that you have in our economies. It's actually very, very difficult. If you put that in perspective, for example, also in Europe, in most countries, the concentration of economic dynamism and of investment has happened in the bigger cities and in the capitals, and it's more or less what it's been seeing across other parts of the world. On the whole idea of AI, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, Leonie, here, but AI is a challenge. And first, does it create a backlash? I don't know, but I am much more hopeful for AI, and I'm starting to do research on the territorial implications of AI. Because if there's anything that is more polarized than politics in these days, is innovation and the capacity of generating new activities, which is concentrated in certain places. The good thing about AI relative to other sources of innovation, like, for example, investing in research and development, is that despite the fact that the entry barriers are high, they are lower than for big research projects, the big missions that, for example, the European Union wants to promote. And what we're finding in the case of China or in the case of Europe is that particularly those places that are putting more emphasis on AI, and China is doing, and the US is doing it much more than Europe, we are losing the battle big time. So we were miles above China until 2016. Now we are miles behind China in that respect. But the barriers to entry are lower, what we're finding is that the returns of investment in AI for economic development are high across the board, but they tend to be far higher in those areas that were lagging behind or that have fallen behind. Why? Because first, the cost of going into it is lower, and the adaptation to new techniques and new methods brought by AI is actually leading to more economic dynamism in those regions that are at the bottom or especially in the middle of the pile.
Colleagues, do you want to say anything to any of the questions?
I was going to come in on the point about voters, Biden's IRA, for instance. I mean, if you're expecting voters to be grateful for the things you do for them, find a different game to play. if you look at the UK, for instance, and the PISA scores for kids in English schools, much better now than they were 14 years ago. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a single voter in the UK who's going to reward the Conservative Party for that at the election. They just not, hasn't cut through. No one knows it, and if they do, they don't care. There are other issues going on as well. I think there are exceptions to this, and I think the mayoral elections recently in England could be an example of that. If you think about Ben Houchen in Tees Valley, where we run focus groups there talking to voters, and what they mention is the redevelopment of the Tees Works and all the things that Ben is building. They can see things being built. People don't notice GDP. But what they do see is buildings. So if you want to do something like a quick fix, you want to spend some money, get some votes for it, you should build things rather than talking about X percentage increase in investment that has raised the GDP per hour worked to this area by X amount. No one cares.
Thank you.
A very quick comment on the whole discussion around place-based policies, let's call them for what they are. one thing we know from the literature, and there's a mountain of empirical evidence showing that place-based policies are quite effective. However, their positive effects attenuate quite sharply with distance. So that when you actually have some sort of an aggregation bias, and those of you who work with data will understand me better, that if you actually aggregate the performance of states at the state level, things may look really good or things may look really bad. This is the typical case of Simpson's paradox, as you all know. But if you look at which part of a state is particularly performing better, you will see a great degree of variation from one state to another, as the states within the USA are not standardized in any shape or form, or they don't really follow any functionality the way we often work with when it comes to functional regions of Europe, that we no longer rely on administrative boundaries when we're talking about economic prosperity or decline or growth, really, that Europe has been doing rather well when it comes to defining the relevant level of geography to work with when it comes to a particular question. But in the case of US, the core periphery divide is really, really harsh the way I see it, at least for most of the states that's been pointed out to be performing quite well. The moment you move by our distance, and I want to talk about the commuting distance, not necessarily the Euclidean distance, by the time you move 45 to an hour away from these major cities that's been doing really well in the states, you end up in places that are out of this world, that are frozen in the 80s almost, both in terms of infrastructure, in terms of its cultural content, in terms of their access to any hard or soft infrastructure, but also to, you know, basic education and economic opportunities. So US is a very specific case in that sense. And I think when we're talking about how places in the states perform, we are often not working at the right geographical aggregation.
Okay, thank you very much. We could go on, but I want to take some more questions, maybe from the online audience. Is there a couple of questions there?
So we have a question from Ian online. Do you think that the term far right is always useful? The successful parties recently were a broad spectrum politically. Politically, they shared a more nativist outlook and a less globalist view. That is, they had a concern with their own experience. Perhaps the term far right is simply closing down the debate. So, for example, on migration, parties that seek more regulated migration are always considered far right.
Is there another question as well? Or otherwise, I'll take another one from the room.
There was another question. Being skeptical could be considered healthy for debate and for freedom. So why is there often a pejorative slant to the word, use of the word Euroscepticism?
Okay, on the words. And one more here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew Campbell from Wales. So, like the examples of Great Yarmouth and Brighton, but next time Tenby and Aberystwyth into your Almeria thing. Now just pulling your leg. Thank you very much. Great presentations. You started off by talking about the European elections, and I was really interested, as everyone has been, with Macron's response to that. So I'd just be interested to know how you think that's going to play out.
Okay, three very different questions. Please address them as you...
I mean, the online questions are quite relevant to my initial point, basically, that the very language we use, the semantic of it, loses its meaning by and large as we move through the structural change we observe in the way politics is done in almost all of the countries we have at hand. And this is precisely what we were discussing before coming into this room with Professor Pose, is that some 10 years ago, at the peak of the migration crisis, when, again, Sweden Democrats were polling around 5%, the position that they held was considered extreme right, far right, which was regulated migration. And there was a lag in response from the center politics, and that lag costed a lot, as a matter of fact. And now they are the second largest political party, and they are actually polling 22%. And the very position they held about 10 years ago is the position that any political party today in Sweden holds. So on which basis we still call this political movement far right, that's debatable, right? So our understanding of what is far and what is center needs to be reevaluated again and again and again. But also, I think it doesn't matter so much what kind of positions individual parties hold if the positions themselves keep changing. And we were talking about the fact that I'm quite agnostic at this point towards the success of individual parties, but I am more interested in what their position is on certain issues to a larger extent. And I think party politics is in decline in general, regardless of what political party we are talking about.
So on far right, I think having terminology is useful, and if far right communicates a vibe on being more immigration skeptic than average or more opposed to environmental policies than average, then it's useful in that sense. But beyond that, I don't really see it being a great term to use, just because a lot of the time we're talking about there are kind of two main axes to political parties. There's their economic views being interventionist or free market, and then there are their social views being authoritarian and liberal. These are orthogonal to each other. And so far right gets you on one of those axes, the liberal authoritarian axis, but doesn't really tell you anything at all about their views on the economy.
That's right.
And that's why you can have, in the UK, the Reform Party are quite libertarian on economics. But then you can look at European parties who are also considered far right, and they're much more interventionist, much more statist in their view on what the government's role should be in the economy.
Yes.
So it's a mix. But I think I lean towards it not being super useful.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. If I can, I'll take the what's wrong with being skeptic. There's nothing wrong. And we in universities, we should be a skeptic. We should challenge everything and come with solutions. But let me just frame it in the European context. And Osgood was talking about soap operas. I'm not going to bring soap operas here because I don't watch soap operas. But what I do is I watch films. So I'm going to start with going back to The Life of Brian. And in The Life of Brian, there was John Cleese and Eric Idle and Michael Palin all together in the revolutionary army against the Roman occupation. And the question was, what have the Romans done for us? But what have the Romans have done for us? And then one says, oh, but they brought sanitation and they fought crime. You remember how dirty the streets were before, and the aqueduct and the baths and everything. So suddenly they realize that there's a lot of advantages of being in Rome. And the same applies to the European Union. I was born in the late 60s in a country that was born under a dictatorship that was far poorer, far less established, far less dynamic. And my parents had lived through a terrible civil war, as many of your grandparents and grandparents had lived through the Second World War that devastated the whole of Europe. I've been the luckiest generation ever. Why? Because my country of origin, I lived in this country in the UK for 30 years, but is far more prosperous, far more stable, far more democratic, far more peaceful than it has ever been. And in no mean part, it's because it has become part of a bigger thing. So what we have is imperfect, but it can be improved. And then I go back to wrap it up to another film, which is Gladiator, in which what you have is Maximus, the great general, who is anointed by Marcus Aurelius, the aging emperor, as his heir-to-be in front of his son. And he says, you've never been to Rome, but yet you fought for Rome. And why is it that you defend Rome so much? And he said, Rome is the light. And why is it the light? Because I've seen much of the outside world in my fights, and it's dark, it's cruel, and it's not what I want for my family. So Rome is the light. What I'll say is we have a light, which is the European Union, which is imperfect, which needs reform, which can be improved, which can be simplified, as Oscar was highlighting, but is far, far better than any alternative that at the moment we have on the table. In fact, most of the alternative we have on the table is going back to the same situation that our parents face, simply because, and this is where we go, I think in the European Parliament, all these, call it extreme, populist, anti-system parties cannot be in the same group. Why? Because for the German Alternative für Deutschland, the European integration is a plot done for and by the Italians to actually get all the benefits of the industrious Germans. Whereas for the Italians, Fratelli Italia or the Lega, the European Union is a plot by the Germans to make sure that they suck out all the resources from Italy and concentrate all the power in Germany. If that's the future we want for the whole of Europe, it's one that I must say we need to be a skeptic, but we need to be skeptic in a way that actually supports something that has worked and has worked very well for the 70 years of existence.
Thank you very much, Andres, and colleagues. I mean, well, I'm going to finish with, I saw two questions over there, so I'm going to finish, a man over there, and the woman over at the back, yeah. And those will be the final questions because we're running out of time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Benedek from Complutense University in Madrid. Professor Rodriguez-Posay was very interestingly and rightly explaining that we have been living in a world which has been better than anything before we have known. I fully agree. I mean, myself, I was born in a communist country. So the question is, we are talking a lot about the anti-systematic views of the far right, yet they do not really challenge the economic system as much as the far left. So should we talk about the far left as well? And we have had them in Greece in power for quite a number of years. In Spain, one can argue they are still in power. So why do we not talk about the far left?
No. Thank you. And just one more, because we wrap up.
Really quick question, because Europe has actually given the answer. They said no. They basically voted the CDU and the AfD are the big surprise. I mean, the AfD is even more a surprise how many percentage they got in all over Europe. So people don't want experimentation anymore. That's what it tells me. Okay. Because they feel they don't profit from it.
Thank you. Oscar, you wanted to come back on.
Far left. Yeah. Why not? Why don't we talk about far left? With a few exceptions, they're not performing very well. I mean, being far left doesn't pay off for the obvious reasons. Being far right, on the other hand, when I look at the far left position in most of the member states, they are not as flexible as what was formerly far-right. There's a lot to learn from what we call far-right politics, that it's extremely flexible. Its focus can change overnight on extremely complex issues. The political narrative is very simple, often unfeasible, yet quite simple. I mean, that is the definition of the populist politics that's being carried out by the far-right politicians. Find a complex problem where people have a massive disagreement over and throw extremely simple solutions that you know are not feasible at them. That's pretty much the game that's being played. And that they do in an extremely flexible fashion until that position becomes quite mainstream. I see none of it in far left, to be honest. So there's nothing really to talk about there, I guess.
I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I think that there's a new cleavage. This idea of left, what is left and right for me doesn't mean anything anymore. Because as you were saying, there's within the, even the populist parties to the right, in economic terms, there's a complete raft of from high levels of interventionism to being extremely libertarian. So the biggest cleavage for me is now, are you pro-system or anti-system? Being pro-system doesn't mean that you want to take everything and do not reform it. Although probably, as you were saying, there's a large share of the population doesn't want much more reform. But it means that you want to reform the system from the inside. You are anti-system. That includes extreme left and extreme right, but fundamentally populists, is that you want to make the system explode. And what you're proposing is so diverse and, in my view, so dangerous that it doesn't matter whether you're far right or far left. It's a suboptimal solution relative to what we have, which is far better. It doesn't mean that we cannot propose any better things, but they have to be put on the table, and we haven't yet seen them.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for all your amazing interventions. It feels like we just got the top of the iceberg of a really important set of discussions, but we have no time to continue. Thank you to the audience online and also here in the theatre for your questions and your engagement for coming here today. And thank you very much, Özgür, James, Andres, for fascinating presentations. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.